Welcome to Future Makers, your invitation to cutting-edge debates on our changing society with leading thinkers from the University of Oxford and beyond. We heard on our previous episodes of Future Makers about the political progress that has or hasn't been made towards achieving a greener country and a greener planet. Much of that discussion concerned actions within a framework of geopolitical understanding between nation-states and large multinational corporations. But beneath this global scale, is there still potential for actions on an individual level to shape the future of the planet? Can changes in our own behaviour, such as eating differently, varying how we commute, or even joining in with mass demonstrations, be anywhere near as effective as changes that are made on an international level? Can I, as an individual, help to save the planet? With me to discuss this today are Professor Susan Jebb, a nutrition scientist who is co-director of the Livestock, Environment and People, or LEAP, project, Dr. Tina Fawcett, a senior researcher at the Environmental Change Institute who works on the ECI's energy programme, and Tristram Walsh, president of the Oxford Climate Society, a student society dedicated to developing informed climate leaders. Welcome to you all. Thank you for coming.
Hello.
Thanks.
Tina, if we could start with you. It strikes me that to talk about potential change, we first need to understand exactly how much individuals do contribute to climate change.
Right, and to understand that, a place we'd start is we would look at the national greenhouse gas emissions. So if we look at the UK, we can see about 80% of our emissions come from fossil fuel energy use, and the other 20% come from other things, particularly methane as a gas which comes from farming practices. And so within that fossil fuel energy use, about half of that, again, is used directly by people in their households and for personal travel, and the other half is used in the rest of the economy. So if we think about us as individuals, the things that are directly under our control, our household energy use, our travel and food, those are probably the three things that we have most day-to-day control over that have the biggest impact on climate change.
Right. And to what extent do you think it's feasible to get large-scale change on those things through individuals modifying their behaviour?
Well, I think both individual change and system change are important, and of course they're linked. So when we do research into the energy system, we tend to treat it as a system, as a socio-technical system that involves people and organisations and behaviours and technologies and economics and a whole raft of things. So while individual behaviour is very important and you can't leave that out, it's not the only thing that matters. So, I mean, I think it's most obvious in transport. You know, if you live in the countryside and there's no bus service and you have to drive to work and there aren't any closer jobs and you can't afford an electric vehicle and in any case you haven't got a driveway so you can't charge it, there's a series of things that would prevent you from making a choice to go down a low carbon transport route at the moment. But we know by 2050 we've got to have net zero carbon emissions across the UK. So a whole lot of systems will have to change and people will have to make individual choices to make that possible.
At least with transport, it's relatively easy to see, I take it, the impact that that is having in terms of energy use. We go and buy our petrol and we can see how much we're consuming and so forth. And where it's possible, we can change to public transport or bicycles and so forth. What about, you mentioned energy within the home as another major contributor.
Yes, that's right. And energy in the home, of course, we all have energy bills. So in theory, we know how much energy we're using. In practice, actually, quite a lot of us don't. But most energy in most homes goes for heating and hot water. And then most electricity use will be in lighting and appliances, mostly appliances. Now the good news is that actually because of, various things that have changed, energy use in the UK residential sector is going down. So most of us are using less energy for heating and hot water than we were, and we're using a bit less energy and electricity than we were.
And why is that?
It's partly technology change. So we've got much more efficient, particularly gas boilers than we used to. Most people use gas for heating and hot water. And because of a series of technical changes and minimum standards from the European Union, actually, we now have much more efficient boilers than we used to. The other big change is that people have invested in the renovation of their homes to be more energy efficient. So particularly loft insulation, cavity wall insulation, increased use of double glazing. There's a series of things that people have taken up, often backed by government policy or European level policy, but people have engaged with that to improve the efficiency of their homes. There's a lot more to do, but the good thing is, unlike transport, which hasn't, energy use hasn't gone down, energy use has been declining in the residential sector.
And might part of the reason for that be that we've got a direct motivation to save energy within our own homes because, as a result, our fuel bills are less?
Well, of course, if you use your car less, your fuel bill would also be less. So I'm not sure it's not just about economics. I think a lot of it is about policy and some of it is about benefits. And it doesn't benefit anybody to have an inefficient home where they're wasting energy. I mean, there's just no upside to that whatsoever. Whereas driving your own personal car rather than getting in a bus, actually, there are quite a lot of upsides. Yes. So yes. Perhaps it's something about that.
No, understood. And we'll probably come back to that later. The third thing you mentioned was food. And Susan, I'd like to bring you in on that. Tell us about the energy use in our food.
Well, there's a lot of parallels really with Tina's comments around energy, because of course what we eat is at the end of the day a voluntary decision. We do choose what to put into our mouths, but what's on the end of your fork is really the end result of a whole food system which has got economics and politics and preferences and social influences are all impacting on that. And so individuals' ability to change is very much a function of the environment in which they live. And so if we want to see real change happen, yes, individuals can do things, but they probably need to be enabled by the system if we're really going to accelerate that change. And as the system changes, individuals will find it easier to change. And so we need to try to create this virtuous circle where we're all heading in the same direction. People in their calm, rational moments mostly agree we want a sustainable food system. But the problem is, in the immediacy of eating, we don't really think about it very much at all. You know, it's in your mouth before you've thought through the supply chain and all of the environmental impacts of that decision. We're constantly amazed, actually, in surveys, how few people really recognise that what they eat has a substantial environmental impact. And that's partly about eating too much. Obesity is a huge public health crisis. But if people are eating too much, then obviously all of that food, as extra food, which is not good for your health, has also created environmental harm in that production. Livestock's very important. We heard that the farming sector's a big contributor to greenhouse gas emissions, methane and so forth. And water usage. The water that it takes to produce one steak is the equivalent of a 5-minute shower every day for 2 months. That is a huge amount of what we call embedded water. Most people have no idea of that. And so whilst we might be a little bit conscious about our water use, we don't really think that eating a steak is part of that. So I think when it comes to food, it's about obesity, it's about meat consumption. And then the third big thing is food waste. And a little bit like Tina mentioned about it's not in anybody's interest to waste energy in the home. It's not in anybody's interest to waste food, yet we continue to do it. And some of that's in the supply chain, but I'm sorry to say a lot of that is at household level as well. And if there is one thing that we could all agree on is a bad idea, it's wasting food. And we've got to get back to a culture where we do not let food go to waste.
Right. Now, you've talked about change taking place within a system, but your last example of food waste, there it doesn't look like there's a system at play. It's just individuals being careless.
Food waste is happening right through the food chain. I don't think it is just individuals, but that's a very specific thing. When it comes to overconsumption, that's heavily driven by the food environment in which we live. Huge portions, lots of marketing, 2-for-1 deals, all conspire to make us eat a little bit more than we actually need. And when it comes to meat, many of us end up eating a meat meal because that's kind of the norm, that's the standard offer. When you dine in college, the standard meal is the meat one. You could choose a vegetarian option, but that requires you to make a conscious decision to do so. There's good evidence that if you flip that around, if you change the default, whereby the standard is vegetarian, actually relatively few people will choose to opt into eating meat because we're social animals, we kind of go with the herd. And if everybody else is having a plant-based meal, then we'll probably do that too.
That's very interesting. Can you characterise the difference in contribution to the climate between meat and vegetarian?
Oh, absolutely. There have been big reports done by scientists here in Oxford, which have looked at the environmental and health impact of the diet we currently consume. And then they've looked at how we would need to change that to really stay within what we call planetary boundaries with respect to climate change, water use and so forth. Perhaps the most marked feature that comes out of that modelling is the need to reduce the amount of animal products that we have, meat and dairy, probably down to around about one serving a week of meat is what's needed if we're really going to achieve the scale of change necessary to stop global warming. Now, that's almost more than most people can contemplate. But what I think it does is tell us about the scale of change that's going to be necessary. This isn't about fiddling at the edges. We need to do something really quite marked.
How do you see that happening? Through government action, through individual action? You talked about changing the general climate of opinion so people by default act differently. How do you see that coming about?
I think individual action is an incredibly important place to start. We're already seeing more and more people are reducing their meat consumption, are turning to plant-based meals. And as more people do it, it becomes more and more normal. It doesn't seem an odd thing to do. It feels like quite a trendy thing to do. It feels like what everybody's doing. So individuals start building up into a whole collection of individuals has a bigger impact. And then they start to change social norms. It becomes socially acceptable to say you're vegetarian, for example. And so things like Veganuary really helps with that because suddenly you're part of a movement. So we're starting to see social movements developing. And the other thing that that individual effort, that collective effort builds, is a willingness amongst policymakers to start taking action. You know, they're quite conservative. They don't want to do things that voters won't like. But what they're good at doing is building on a trend. And so if they see people are heading in that direction, they'll be more willing to take the policy steps which will accelerate change and to put pressure, whether that's, you know, on industry or elsewhere, to change the environment. It's also the case that individuals changing will mean that food businesses start changing. We're seeing supermarkets responding with far more plant-based meals now because more consumers are asking for that. And we've got a very competitive food system. What you see in the shelves today is mostly what you bought last week. So once you start buying differently, the supermarkets will respond very, very quickly. Now, they also have a leadership role too. Partly what we eat is what's offered and promoted to us. But individuals have an important role in catalysing change, because in the food system, consumers have a very powerful position. I think the changes that we're seeing in food are interesting because if we look at the rise in things like Veganuary, that's really driven by young people, by social media. Tristan, I don't know how you feel about that. Is the sort of vegan movement helpful, or actually is that a bit alienating for some people? I can't make up my mind how I feel about it.
So like you, I also can't make up my mind, but there are some interesting pointers on both sides. So firstly, it's really interesting. I think it's certainly true in my experience that the social aspect of dietary choices is a very large part of why people do this. And I think this shouldn't be downplayed. And so from personal experience, the experience of lots of the young people I know, the most difficult part in dietary change is just that transition couple of weeks. Once you've transitioned to reducing your meat consumption, actually it follows very, very easy from there. But when you're hearing about what you're saying, like just cutting your meat consumption down to maybe 3 times a day to once per week, it sounds totally overwhelming. And so if you're in a social situation, for example, lots of my friends are vegetarian, I just started eating out with them, and then I would just buy the vegetarian option alongside all of the rest of them. It wasn't really a conscious decision. It becomes very easy to do that. And then once you've started seeing how easy that shift is, then the rest follows very easily.
It's interesting. We've just finished a trial here where we asked people to take a meat-free challenge for a month. And we thought we would help them by giving them, if you like, very obvious plant-based alternatives, so, you know, vegetarian sausages rather than regular sausages. And to make it as easy as possible, we provided them for free for a month, really to just help people make that change. But what we were interested in is what happened after that. And we saw some really fascinating effects. Firstly, once we made it super easy, because this stuff was in their fridge, actually people dropped their meat consumption like a stone. But after that, what people reported is their meat went up a little bit, but actually quite a small amount, though they mostly stopped using those meat alternatives. And actually, they'd realised that that was a little bit dull, but oh my goodness, there was all these other recipes they could cook. So we saw that those, if you like, meat alternatives seemed to give people a bit of a gateway into more plant-based eating, and maybe also taking part in the trial made it a sort of socially legitimate thing to do. Oh, well, I'm in a research project, so and I think you're right, we have to help people just make that first step, and maybe that's where veganuary and things like that really help. Even if you don't become vegan, you actually get jolted into doing something a bit different.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's interesting as well, looking at the way that people are labeling, like, become a vegetarian or become a vegan. The goal, in a way, seems to be shifting now towards just becoming vegan rather than necessarily trying to achieve the social and environmental sort of justice goals that come along with those. And so, again, from experience, it seems like when people try to focus too much on, like, I will try and cut meat out of my diet, or I will try and become vegan, it often doesn't last very long, and so it might be really successful in reducing their environmental footprint for a very short period of time, but quite quickly it can revert back, and you end up with these sort of wild swings between being vegan for 1 week and then eating a ton of meat the next week. And overall, you would have been better just reducing your meat consumption by 70% and just doing that for a long time. And so I think I would always try and encourage people not to try and focus too much on, you must be a vegan, but just reduce your consumption, maybe ratchet, start by just taking one meal per day and move from there. And a lot of it comes down to, I think, the empathy as well. So trying to think about, like, well, why are you doing this? Because again, you're making this decision every single day. And so if you can't remember why you're doing this, the change has become quite difficult. And so I think it's been quite instructive for people as well, thinking, if you have the two options in front of you, just remind yourself, okay, is it worth the damages? You have to be aware of the damages first, like you were speaking to earlier. And then just ask yourself the question, I can take both of these sandwiches now, they're both equally delicious. Do I want to look the person who this is going to be damaging in the eyes and say, I opted not to take the least damaging option? And this makes it quite easy, I think.
That's really interesting, because you've articulated a whole load of behavioural mechanisms. You know, one is social support. It really helps if people around you are doing it as well and you feel it's a supportive environment. There's a thing about self-identity. You know, if you see yourself as a meat reducer, then none of us like the cognitive dissonance that comes from then tucking into steak and chips. The self-monitoring, many of us don't actually realise how often we're eating meat. When we ask people how often they have a meat meal, they give us a number. Then they keep a food diary, and it's way more. And that's because they don't really count a ham sandwich as a meat meal. It was a sandwich, you know, or a beef lasagna. That was a lasagna. It wasn't a meat meal. So, you know, what we've realised is helping people to become more conscious of what they're eating, thinking about why they're doing it, developing this self-identity, surrounding them with social support. All of these things make it easier for individuals to change.
And a lot here is to do with the perception of why one is becoming vegan. Is thinking about the environment the main factor? Because it could also be animal welfare, it could be personal health.
So I'm in a bubble within a bubble within a bubble, being in the UK, in Oxford, at Oxford University, at the Climate Society. So the vast majority of people I know are vegetarian or vegan, and that extends right the way through from school students all the way up to professors.
And that is for climate reasons.
And a lot of that is for climate reasons. Having said that, these things are viewed as quite siloed, but really they're not. So if you're interested in animal welfare and also the environment, you can not kill two birds, but you can... you can save two birds with one vegetable sandwich.
Speaking here as a philosophy professor, I think historically most of my students whom I've encountered who've been vegetarians or vegans, it's been more to do with animal welfare. And I wonder if it might actually help if there was more consciousness out there that this is very much a climate issue.
When we have done public surveys, omnibus surveys, or indeed focus groups with people about their meat-eating habits, we do very often see that the people who are vegan are doing that because of fundamentally because of animal welfare reasons. They might draw on other things as well, but that's a big driver. But for people who do eat meat, actually animal welfare doesn't really seem to be a big motivator, because if you do think that's an important issue, then it's hard to do the halfway house. Most individuals actually are motivated by their health. So they think it would perhaps be better for their own personal health. And that's perhaps people looking to get something out of it for themselves. We know eating a lot of meat increases your risk of colorectal cancer and of heart disease. But where I think the change is happening is in people beginning to understand the environmental impact. You know, in the same way that suddenly people have woken up to the damage caused by plastics, for example. It's almost, I hope we're close to a tipping point where people suddenly start to really understand their food choices impact on the environment. You know, another of my factoids, you know, one steak is the equivalent of driving from Oxford to Milton Keynes. And we kind of know driving's kind of not a good thing, but we don't worry so much, I think, about what we're eating.
And perhaps also past a certain point, once we reach this tipping point, it doesn't matter why people are doing it, but more just that they're doing it. So you will always have the, sort of the trendsetters and the people making the most progress early on, and they will be the people who are very conscious and aware of trying to make a difference for animal rights or whether it's climate change. But once we get past, I don't know what the percentage is, a certain percentage, we're already starting to see, for example, the culinary world getting really interested in vegan food festivals, and Otto Lengi has entirely vegetarian cookbooks, not because he's vegetarian, just because he enjoys cooking those sorts of meals. And so past a certain threshold, people will just be doing it because it's trendy. And increasingly on social media, we can see people sharing their Buddha bowls, I think they're called, and all sorts of delicious vegan foods because it just looks good. And the aesthetic that you can curate online of this vegan millennial lifestyle is quite appealing to a lot of young people.
Yeah, so it becomes something that you do because it's stylish and attractive and interesting rather than being the sort of really rather dull.
And so long as it has a staying power, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that.
No. Tina?
You were talking earlier about making it normal. What's the norm and what do you expect? So, for example, in a research collaboration I'm in at the moment called CREDS, which is the Centre for Research into Energy Demand Solutions, we're a multi-university centre. The catering at our events is vegetarian only. That's the norm. And then, of course, you can ask for vegan or gluten-free or whatever else you need. But in another research collaboration I was in about 10 or 12 years ago, we had the same policy. And then there was quite a lot of kickback against it. I mean, we carried on, but there was quite a lot of kickback against that. And I think this time it hasn't, if people are thinking badly of it, they're certainly muttering under their breath rather than complaining loudly in meetings. But I think that sort of embedding new norms is quite important. And, you know, for example, so that's something that we do as professionals in the university. And there has been quite a big discussion lately about academics, particularly flying abroad to conferences. And the big professional conference I go to is in the south of France, and nearly all of us get the train down there because we can. But if the big professional conference was in the US, well, we'd be in trouble because we haven't all got, you know, friends with super yachts or whatever. So we, you know, trying to embed new normal things is, you know, is quite powerful. And that can be part of our work life that carries through into our personal life, or can work the other way around as well, actually.
With regard to transport, I mean, you've put your finger on a very important issue there, that lots of academics, lots of people in business have meetings around the world. If it's nearby, or relatively nearby, we can get a train or the Eurostar. But if it's at a long distance, we have to fly, don't we?
Well, yes. I mean, we feel we have to fly at the moment. And that's the way our sort of, for some of us, our working lives are structured. And so people feel locked into that. They might be able to ask to do a remote meeting. That might not be possible. They might be worried about losing the business. They might be worried about compromising their job. So, I mean, I think that's why we come back to talking all the time about the limits of individual action within a system that is structured to encourage people to do more and more longer distance travel. I mean, that's, individuals can only fight so far against that sort of overwhelming system requirement that they travel further and faster, which, you know, that's just not compatible with living in a safe climate. So we've got to tackle those pressures as well as think about our individual choices, because after all, most air travel is undertaken by a minority of people. Most of it is for holidays. Half of people in the UK won't fly in any particular year. If you look globally, most people globally have never been on a plane. We're not all making the same sort of choices. Some of us are making much higher carbon and greenhouse gas emitting choices than other people. Some people feel trapped into those choices. Other people are making them because that's the holiday they want. And we've got to start rethinking all of that, because while there might be technical answers to quite a lot of things, there's no technical fix for flying that we know of at the moment. We've just got to reduce the amount of flying that we do and perhaps share whatever we think is a reasonable flying budget between more people, not just make it all part of, you know, the global elite.
Right, thank you. So we've looked at food, we've got transport, and what about energy?
Well, I think energy use in homes, in theory, that ought to be the easiest place to make choices, because as we've already said, people don't like wasting energy, and insulating your home, I mean, that should be win-win. You know, you use less energy, you pay less on your bills, you usually live in a more comfortable home. There's quite a lot of people still in our country who are underheated. They're not warm enough, they're getting ill. We call that a condition of fuel poverty, where people can't afford to be warm enough. And if you can ensure that people are living in better quality homes, they use less energy, they're healthier, it's good. But, you know, it's not trivial to insulate all our homes. I mean, having insulated my own home, you know, it can be expensive. It doesn't have to be, but it can be, depending on the home you've got. It can take time, it takes energy. You've got to find somebody with the right skills. So again, we need to gear up the system so homeowners and landlords are able to access high quality renovation and find ways for paying for that, and actually value it as a society, value living in a warm, comfortable, well-insulated home, and be prepared to pay for that.
So these are all, I guess, behavioural changes in your consumption patterns. What I'm curious about is as well shifting where you're getting your energy from to a purely renewable source. So increasing your efficiency is only going to get so far if you're still buying it from a dirty supplier. So we've seen increasing young people, there's a big movement to get your energy from a 100% renewable source. In almost every case, myself and everyone I know has cut a significant amount of money off their energy bill from doing this. So can you see any of the downsides to doing this, or any difficulties with this approach?
I mean, I would never say to people not to go for a renewable energy supplier, which at the moment really means electricity supplier. I mean, there isn't, you know, if you're using natural gas for heating, which most people do, that's quite hard to go green on at the moment. But you can certainly buy your electricity from a renewable supplier. It's quite complicated how electricity is accounted for and how the carbon emissions are accounted for. And in some cases, buying a green tariff means the rest of the electricity system is going browner, so it's going less green. In some cases, your renewable energy electricity supplier is actually investing new money in renewable electricity generation. So I think it's never a bad thing to do. It might not be doing quite as much good as you think it is. And my message always would be, first, reduce your energy use, and then replace what's, you know, supply what's left with as renewable a source as you can.
Could I just ask you to elaborate a little bit on what you mean by going browner? So in my picture of the economy, in my head, it was like, if you bought a renewable source, that would be a vote for that sort of economy for the energy, and therefore they would build more of that to live up to the capacity. I admit this is probably quite a simplistic viewpoint. So how might buying renewables make the rest of the grid go browner?
Well, it's just if the way in which they meet their promise to you to supply from renewables is by buying sort of renewable electricity on the market, but no additional investment is put into new renewables, what it means is the people who are supplying non-badged electricity, just ordinary sort of electricity, might have less renewables in their mix, but their customers won't know because they haven't asked that question, and that's not why they're buying it. So it's I'm sorry, I can't give a really clear explanation of this. It's because it's a really complicated market, and I don't have it clear enough in my mind to explain in two sentences why it might not always be as good as you hope that it would be.
Right, so these things are obviously much more complicated than they often seem at first sight. As individuals, even making a choice to shift energy supplier might not be having the impact that we hoped it would.
But saving energy will always have the impact that we hope it would.
Yes, good point. But you said earlier that with regard to transport, certainly what we need is actually systemic change. And obviously in energy generation, the same issue is coming up. How are we going to get that systemic change? Is that going to require legislation, or can lots of individuals acting either as individuals or as organised groups, can they somehow bring about this large-scale change that we need?
Well, I think individuals can accelerate the changes for sure, but it's hard to imagine that they can do it all on their own because the system that we live in is so powerful in determining our energy use, in determining our transport choices, and in determining what we eat. So we've seen in general, in terms of diets, that when you get what we might call upstream action, it delivers a benefit across the whole population.
When you say upstream, you mean?
So this is not individuals making choices. This is making generally policy interventions, which happen much earlier, much higher up the system.
From the government or exactly. The EU or wherever.
If you rely on individuals, you've got to win over their hearts and minds. They've got to want to do it. And then in general, they're going to have to invest quite a lot of cognitive effort in actually making that happen because the system's not really set up like that. If, however, you make an intervention upstream, which changes the environment for everybody, then not only will it make it easier for the people who were trying to do it anyway, but you will also impact on all of those people who haven't given it a second thought, just by default. And so what you then achieve is perhaps a smaller change, but over far more people. So it's a question of, do we want one or two absolutely committed people to become vegan, or do we want everybody to reduce their meat consumption by 20% or by a much smaller amount? And so those policy level interventions tend to be very good at generating that system level change, which affects the whole population. And these two things are not separate. You know, the more individuals want to do it, the more policymakers will step in. And the more policy changes the system, the more people by default will do the more environmentally sensitive things.
And the sort of policy changes you're talking about here sound more like nudges than compulsion. Is that right?
I think in food, there are very few things that you can do on a compulsory basis. It's quite hard to envisage that we're going to ban any one food. And I don't think there's any case for that because this is a sort of continuous measure, really. And so the question is, how far do you want to infringe people's personal autonomy, personal freedom? So the kinds of things that you might suggest, for example, that supermarkets could do, really are in the nudge territory. If you make the plant-based choices more available, more prominent at eye level, if you remove some of the less sustainable choices and put them in more inaccessible places in the supermarket, you're going to change behaviour. If you take canteens, we're used to having, you know, there's the meat option, then there's the veggie option. Actually, if you put them the other way around and the veggie option's first, more people will choose it. Those are nudges. On the other hand, we also know that you can take some kind of harder policy, what we think of as harder policy measures, which would be some of the fiscal interventions. None of us tend to like tax. We all think that would be a bad idea. But it's very clear that if you put up the price of a product, people buy an awful lot less of it. We've seen taxes applied in relation to sugary drinks. From a health perspective, you could think of taxes applied for the less sustainable choices.
And would you do this on the basis of the carbon emissions or the use of water?
There are a whole host of different ways that you can do it. But what we first of all have to accept is the principle that actually we would have a system in which the price of food bore some relationship to its environmental impact. People don't like the idea of tax, but at the moment, the price of food is heavily influenced by the whole trade agreements. And so it's not so unreasonable to imagine that we should be getting people to pay the real cost of food. And so if you were to account for the cost of water, for example, that's embedded in the meat we eat, the price of meat would shoot up. That isn't necessarily a tax, it's just about people bearing the real cost of what they're doing. That's, again, not compulsion, but it's a great deal firmer than a nudge. Maybe it's a shove in the right direction.
And I think that's quite different from the energy system, where there is a great deal of compulsion. So regulations are used a lot. I think I mentioned earlier, in terms of home energy use, one of the big changes has been that everybody who uses a gas boiler or has bought one in the last 15 years has a much more efficient boiler than they used to have. And you simply can't buy inefficient gas boilers anymore. You can't buy inefficient lights anymore. We probably all remember that we used to use these, what were called incandescent bulbs, very inefficient. Now, most lighting is switching towards LED lighting, having gone through a stage of compact fluorescent lights. And so there's been this big technology change backed up by, you know, regulated minimum standards at the European level, and that have happened across all sorts of products, fridges, freezers, washing machines, lots and lots of things have been, the inefficient stuff has been regulated out.
We could do that in some aspects of food. So, for example, people will be familiar with fish from sustainable sources. Well, we could say, actually, you can't sell fish that comes from unsustainable sources. We could take some action in relation to the way meat is produced, and that we could only produce it through the most environmentally sensitive means. I have to say that would also mean there was far less meat available, so there'd be a sort of double impact. So I think there are some places one could regulate in the food system. And what this discussion, I guess, is really making me think about is we ought to perhaps map out, you know, across energy, transport and food, the different options and see how they play out in those different spheres, because it might open up some ideas for behaviour change, which are being, you know, are seen as obvious in the energy field, which maybe we're not taking advantage of in food and vice versa.
But behaviour change is probably going to have to be both chicken and egg, isn't it? Because I can't see taxes or increased prices of meat and so on becoming politically achievable unless attitudes change.
Oh, but it's all behaviour change. It's just a question of, are you talking about changing the behaviour of individuals, of corporations or of policymakers? But in the end, it's all about changing behaviour.
What I'm thinking is that if you tried to bring in a policy now of changing the costs in such a way that it made meat essentially something that poorer people would have difficulty in purchasing, that's not going to be seen as politically acceptable.
Absolutely. And that takes us right back to building this public license for policymakers to act. And, that's important. But what's interesting is you don't need all that many people to start asking for change to happen. I mean, the tipping points are often sooner than you think. I mean, we've seen this in quite a few other social movements, Tristan, you probably know it better than I do, of change can happen surprisingly quickly.
Yeah, so an interesting statistic that's been thrown around quite a lot at the moment that I've heard a lot of people referencing is a paper that came out of Harvard a couple of years ago, I think it was, looking into what are the tipping point thresholds for success of social movements. And so I think they studied a couple of dozen different, specifically non-violent civil disobedience movements. And they actually found that only 3.5% of the population needed to get behind these before the movement became successful. And the policies got put in place. So it's actually a surprisingly low figure. Of course, this is quite an extreme example, more in line with what we're seeing with Extinction Rebellion and less in line with what we're seeing with dietary changes. But it does give you some sense of an idea that you don't need the entire population to get behind these ideas before the government can put them in place.
It'll be very interesting to see, won't it, if the increasing climate awareness amongst young people actually leads to a broader movement.
People very often say, oh, if only we can influence, you know, young hearts and minds, you know, even primary school children, they'll go home and they'll tell their parents, pester their parents, and, you know, everybody will change. I mean, it's a great and glorious plan. It's sure worth trying. But nonetheless, adults do set the system in which children live to quite a high degree. And so I think we, you know, as in so many areas, have got to take this whole population approach. And people at different ages and stages will change for different reasons, and that those again will become synergistic.
I do have a worry. You mentioned the whole population, and I'm thinking, do we mean the whole population of Britain or the whole population of the wider world?
Well, I think in terms of global responsibility for carbon emissions, we know that Britain's got quite a unique role because actually we industrialised first. So if you look at the sort of historic emissions, you know, per person in a country, we're right up there because of our history and what we've done. And I think to be fair to us as a country, we've always taken quite a leading role in setting quite ambitious climate goals. Now, they might not be as ambitious as they need to be because the science is just getting more and more worrying. But nevertheless, Britain has said it's going to go for a net zero goal by 2050. We have had this leadership role and we have actually done things, and our carbon emissions and our greenhouse gas emissions have been going down. Now, you can debate that when you think about how many of our emissions are now happening overseas. So it's perhaps not as quite as rosy as I'm saying, but I would say that, you know, we've got the technological capacity, we've got the sort of academic capacity, you know, the understanding, we know the sorts of things that need to happen. It's not to say it will be trivially easy to get people on board and to get the political change we need, but we know that can happen here and it can happen in, you know, throughout Europe and the sort of richer countries. We've we've got a lot of the capacity to make these changes if we want to. And one of the reasons we need to change faster is to allow countries, poorer countries who still actually need to use more energy and emit more carbon to meet their basic needs, to give them the space to do that without compromising the global climate. So for sure, it's a balance between different countries, but we're one of the countries that needs to go further and faster on what we're doing.
And so it's interesting as well. So all individual action is positive action. And when you get these widespread movements, it doesn't necessarily require a pro-climate government for it to have an effect. If you do have a quote-unquote good government, these movements can give them the social and political capital they need to put in place better policies. But what we're seeing in countries that don't have a pro-climate government elsewhere in the Anglosphere, actually it's these movements that are taking a huge amount of positive steps forwards. Since Trump has come into the presidency, we've seen a lot of the cities and non-state organizations that have grown largely out of social movements really take up strong action on climate change. And even if we look to Western democratic countries, you can look towards some of the developing nations. And whilst it's certainly true that they will need to emit more carbon for slightly longer potentially in order to catch up, there is also the potential for leapfrogging. And we're seeing a lot of local communities, because they've been so impacted by the local pollution, not necessarily the climate so directly yet, but just the pollution from their cooking appliances and their energy sources. That means that a lot of the local communities are already starting to put in place sort of local grassroots solar projects and better cooking infrastructure.
That's a really important point, because, you know, at the end of the day, there is a big social justice issue in this. So, you know, if you take food, in Britain we need to eat an awful lot less meat in order to allow some other countries to even have the opportunity to eat a little bit more, where it might actually be a bit better for their health if they had a little bit more meat in their diet. But we cannot increase global meat production without causing catastrophic environmental harms. So I think we have got to think hard about our responsibilities in order to allow other countries to have the opportunities that they deserve. But your point about leapfrogging, I think, really matters too. I mean, if we've learned anything about from our own economic development, is that that has been fantastic in many ways, but has brought huge health harms in relation to the rise in non-communicable diseases. So heart disease, diabetes, cancers and so forth. Big proportion of that is diet related. So what we want to be able to do is to help some of the lower middle income countries to have all the benefits of an improved food system. So they have access to healthy foods rather than access to the foods which have done us great harm. And that's a real challenge. But I think it is also an opportunity that, as you say, they just jump past some of the mistakes we've made and gives us a real responsibility to kind of act as a case study. What can you do here? And again, our academic capacity is really important, because if we try things, we've got to evaluate them and see what the impacts are. Because sometimes even the most best intentioned things have unexpected and unintended consequences. And so we really need to evaluate what we're doing. And then when we've got this little toolkit of things which work really, really well, we can for once export something which is tremendously valuable.
It's also interesting hearing you picking up on freedoms being impinged, I think you mentioned at one point. And again, with this of the ethical and the justice issues around this. And let me think, well, it's important always with these things like dietary choices or whatever to think about, again, about the long-term impacts. And so who's freedoms are going to be impinged. And sure, right now, if you regulate, our current food might feel a little bit like we've had some freedom taken away, but ultimately we'll have so much more freedom in the future. As one particular sort of example that I quite like thinking about, we're moving towards existential politics. So entire communities are going to not be able to exist. So to use a UK example, we have, for example, coal miners, and we also have some villages on the coastline. Now they can't both exist. We can't coal mine and still have these coastal villages. And you've got to think, whose freedoms do we most want to enable? Do we want to enable the freedoms of the coal mining communities to still exist, or do we want to enable the freedoms for all of the coastal communities, whether it's in Wales or in London or whatever. And there are quite big questions here about freedom.
The challenge with all these things is there are trade-offs. You know, if this was all a win-win solution, we'd be there by now. And I think we've really got to, A, understand the trade-offs and then think much harder than we have done about how do we mitigate the bad consequences for some sectors of the population or some communities. So if we're talking about eating less meat and we're talking about producing less meat, we've really got to think about the livelihoods of people who have for generations lived through farming. And we can't just pretend that doesn't matter. We've got to start thinking hard about mitigation and how do we help people to make the transition. You know, there are ways of doing that, but it may well require some investment. You know, we grow remarkably little fruit and vegetable in this country. Our horticulture sector is ridiculously small, even though we've got a fantastic climate for it. But for farmers to move into horticulture has huge capital costs. So many of them would be happy to do it, but they just can't afford to make that transition. We need to think about how we're going to help them to do that. So it's about identifying where we want to be, agreeing on that, and then getting that that support. Because groups that are going to lose out become some of the strongest opponents, not surprisingly. So part of our how do we move forward strategy has got to be to help the people who are disadvantaged by the policies to actually come through that.
So some of the most important actions of government here might not be so much legislating about what people eat, but rather making provision so that those whose livelihoods currently depend on meat, for example, find other things to do.
Well, it's about facilitating the change, and that's actually about doing the positive things, but it's also about looking after and mitigating the consequences where actually we're not in a win-win situation.
Well, thank you very much. That's been a fascinating discussion. What I'd like to end with is, where would you recommend individual people start? Having listened to this podcast, what should they go and do? Tina?
Well, I mean, I think to some extent, people probably know what we're going to say. I mean, somebody like me who focuses on energy, I'm probably going to say, don't use your car as much, try and use public transport, try and cycle, try and walk where you can. That's good for your health. And it's also, you know, good for your mental health as well, actually, and reduces local air pollution as well as reducing carbon emissions and climate change. Energy use in homes. I mean, again, these messages are quite familiar. It's around not having your home any warmer than it really needs to be. Put on a jumper in winter rather than turning up the thermostat. Make sure you're not, you know, you're not wasting energy leaving lights on when you, you know, when you don't need them, leaving your window open when you've got your heating on. I mean, there are things like that. But beyond that, there's thinking about the long term, because the government has said from 2025, new homes aren't going to be connected to the gas network. If we're going to have a low carbon, low heating and energy system, actually by 2050, none of us are going to be connected to the gas network. So it's starting to think about, to some extent, the immediate things you can do right now, the things you invest in the medium term, like when I'm next doing some work on my house, actually I'll insulate as well as build my extension. And then there's the sort of much longer term thinking, well, by 2050, we're all, you know, the fuels we use for heating and will have changed quite a bit. And what's that going to look like? And how am I going to start thinking about my home and my life into the future? And if we think about transport, where am I locating myself in relationship to my job? And is that going to be sustainable when the government has already said we're going to not have petrol and diesel vehicles by 2040? But actually that deadline might well come sooner. So, yeah, I'd quite like people to, yes, there's the immediate, there's the sort of housekeeping no-cost measures that you can do straight away. There's the slightly more investment measures, particularly in the fabric of your home or the efficiency of the stuff that you own or owning less stuff, perhaps, that you can do in the medium term. And then there's just gearing yourself up mentally to think, OK, in the longer term, I'm still going to be comfortable in my home, but that's going to be achieved in quite a different way. And how am I getting ready for that?
Thank you. Susan?
One personal example that I've already done is that we have installed a biomass boiler. We used to have oil central heating, And I can't tell you how much better I feel not seeing that oil tanker coming, delivering oil to us, you know, every couple of months. I've got far more personal reward out of that than I remotely imagined was going to be the case. It was a rather economic decision, but it's been a fantastic one. The second thing is, since I've been working more specifically on our LEAP project around the impact of meat on health and the environment, I have for sure become a much more conscious about the amount of meat that I consume, and I've really made active steps to cut down. That's been really interesting because some things are actually remarkably easy. You know, if you don't buy it in the supermarket, therefore it's not in my fridge, then I start cooking other things. I've started actively buying more pulses and then looking out new recipes. So that's been good. I still find it quite difficult when we have friends coming to dinner to actually cook meat-free meals, and I've been really challenging myself why I don't do that. So I think that eating less meat is something we can all do, and I've both seen that's possible, but also seen some of the barriers. And my final one, which is, you know, the school of the blindingly obvious, is value food and don't waste it. When you're eating food, remember and respect all of the environmental resources that went into producing it. We have just got too casual about the way we use food. And it's partly because food is relatively cheap. We spend a pretty small proportion, about 10 or 11% of our income on food. It used to be 30%. And because it's cheap, I think we've just become a bit too casual. So, respect your food, don't waste it. Quality, environmental quality, not quantity.
Thank you. Tristram?
Yeah, so as we've covered, I think it's quite clear from now that we know sort of how to solve climate change and what it is that we need to do. So fundamentally, the issue now is like one of politics and ethics about how we're going to do this in a just way. So a lot of the individual actions, I think, really need to be geared towards putting pressure in the right places to create these larger political changes. We've already talked about personal measures you can take, like your diet. Lots of people have started getting into environmental issues by reducing their plastic usage. A couple of other really popular ones that people at Oxford have been doing is trying to divest your personal finances. So if you're with an environmentally damaging bank, you can try moving your money elsewhere. And also just voting. It's a really, really big thing. We have some parties in the UK that are better for the environment than others. I'm not going to tell you which they are. Do your research. Find out which ones you like the policies for. Don't vote for a party because you've always done that. Actually look at the policies and vote in line with your values. And then, as with all of these things, basically just tell everyone about this. Your personal action makes some difference, and it's important, but not a huge difference. But what you can really do is put some of your time and energy into influencing and educating and informing all of the people around you to do similar sorts of things. So you can now have an individual action that's worth 10 times, 20 times, 100 times what you're doing. And that's where real positive emotions grow.
Telling people about the evidence, I think, really, really matters, because this is one of those areas where you don't need to tell people what we think you should do. You just show them the evidence. And if we can do that in an accessible way, people reach a pretty obvious conclusion about some of the changes that are necessary. And I think in that way, we can get away from preaching and really just trying to create more informed citizens who then absolutely, we can trust to act in line with their values.
So we have done low carbon or low energy retrofit in our homes. That's just one home, right? So we've opened it up under a number of sort of green open doors type schemes to people. And, you know, people come round and you show them your solar panels and your insulation, and they're actually interested in your insulation, which is unusual because most people don't find it very interesting. And so people go away. And what's really nice is on the road next to ours now, they've gone and had external solid wall insulation, as we have done on our house. And they've told us that was us seeing our house was one of the main things that got them into doing it. And that was really nice, actually, because you do your research and you hope it makes a difference in the world, but it's very hard to trace that. Whereas seeing one of your neighbours who's actually done something to their house that you've done to yours that you know will be a positive benefit, I mean, that's really nice.
And when you're communicating with people, I see a lot of people get very frustrated that other people aren't doing more or they don't understand. But if I can say one thing, is just have patience. I mean, again, as we've touched on in this conversation, there's a heck of a lot of grey areas out there. It's really, really complicated. And it is confusing. Now, you can do your best to sort of learn about what sort of things you can be doing, but this is quite challenging material for a lot of people. And so listening to the things that they're struggling with, finding the sort of the kernel of truth in their frustration and difficulties with the issues, I think is very important. We don't want to get into a situation where, like you said before, where we're preaching at people and trying to put pressure on people. This won't lead to sort of changes in people's life where they have ownership of those changes. And we need these resilient changes where people feel like it's their own idea that they're doing. It doesn't really matter where you start, just start somewhere. We always see this being a gateway really for anyone. Whether you start with just buying a plastic straw, very few people buy into lower waste living and then stop there, because it creates this whole sort of more mindful attitude surrounding your consumption. And this, much more often than not, blossoms into a much more conscious way of living that has much deeper effects than just plastic reduction.
Well, thank you very much indeed. That's been a very stimulating discussion, and let's hope that it has lots of good effect beyond the academy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My thanks again to Susan, Tina and Tristram for their time today. I do hope you've also enjoyed what's been another fascinating episode of Future Makers. If you did, why not give us a rating, leave us a review and let us know what you enjoyed the most. Next time, we return to international relationships as we discuss the famous Paris Climate Agreement of 2015 and what changes have taken place as a result. Until then, I'm Peter Milliken, and you've been listening to Future Makers.